Hello, everybody. Welcome to podcast number 8 of the Alexi Sale podcast. Now, I think that me putting all that effort into talking to Stuart Lee in the last podcast has frankly made me complacent. So I've done very little preparation for this. Don't look at me like that. Zencaster provides a video link now, and Talal's looking all. Anyway, I thought it was a big achievement getting Stuart on. So kind of busk this one, really. But I would just like to open with the standard inveighing against Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party. Keir Starmer, of course, is the Labour Party is now 13 points behind in the poll. I remember Tony Blair saying when Corbyn was like 8 points up that he should be 20 points up. So Keir Starmer against Theresa May. Keir Starmer is at least 13 points behind a government that has killed 150,000 of its own population. So I think that's quite an achievement. But so what I'm wondering about is what a lot of people now are coming around to my view of Keir Starmer. I think that he was lauded by the right-wing press, which is all the press, basically, in the first place for being a new broom and so on. But they have become disillusioned with them. And particularly, there's a very Blairite columnist in The Independent called John Rentoul, aptly named John Rentoul, who always says something shitty about Keir Starmer. And also, I think Navarra Media, which is a website that I like a lot, they've got some very interesting things to say. So what I'm wondering is, what is his purpose? Who is he? Who is Keir Starmer? I mean, people say, he seems to be completely lacking in personality. And what I'm starting to wonder is whether he is actually a robot. Think about it, possibly made by British Aerospace or Lockheed Martin or Israel's Elbit Systems, that he is. Because think of that name, right, Keir Starmer. One of my favourite films is The Day of the Jackal, the first one, not the shitty Bruce Willis remake. And in that, the Jackal gets his identity from dead Victorian children. Now think of that name, Keir Starmer. That's not a modern name, is it? I think that is a name that has been stolen off the gravestone of a 9-year-old chimney sweep who died from typhoid in the late 19th century. Just a theory. what is Keir Starmer's purpose? What is the people who programmed him, British Aerospace, Lockheed Martin, or Elbit Systems, what is their intention? Was it to take over the Labour Party and make it kind of slightly more smiley-faced version of the Conservative Party? Or is his purpose actually to destroy the Labour Party, to ensure that Britain is effectively, which to all intents and purposes it is at the moment, a one-party state? So there you are. Keir Starmer, this is a revelation you will not get in the mainstream media. Keir Starmer is a robot, a T-1000 android. He has been made by British Aerospace, Lockheed Martin, and Elbit Systems. Because let's face it, they all make drones, and he's a fucking drone. So now what we're going to do is, I thought this episode, and also, you know, it's a two-way street, podcasting, and so I thought we would deal with some of the emails and messages and that have come into our various receptacles, and use the podcast to talk about that. Really, now I noticed one on the Bike Rides website, which is a guy that says he saw me in, I think it was Glastonbury in '84, and he remembers me nearly hitting him in my car, which he thought was a Red Rover P6. Now he was wrong there. I probably did nearly hit him, but it was a black Rover P5B coupe. Very distinctive car, a car that I bought in 1984 after I had my Hit Hello John got new Metro, and it's, I had it displayed black, and it's also the car that the baddies drive in the Nicholas Rogue film Performance. So that's one of the reasons why I bought it. And if you look at some of my work, you can see Didn't You Kill My Brother video and other, you can see the car lurking in the background. So I bought this car, this Rover P5B coupe, 1970 classic British car. And because I wanted to be different, you know, I wanted to be so I didn't want to drive like an ordinary car of the time. I wanted to be somebody who was special, had a special car. In an early episode of The Simpsons, when Homer invents the flaming Homer, this cocktail which Mo Sizzlak, the bar owner, steals from him. At one point, Mo says, he says, "Rich people, Homer, every minute of the day they think they're happy, but they're not." Which is actually an interesting philosophical question, whether you think, if every day you think you're happy, or, you know, then you are happy, aren't you? You know, a lot of the very early Simpsons episodes, played with kind of philosophical ideas, and there's one there, whether you can delude yourself, whether every day you think you can think you're happy and you're not. But I can kind of go along with that, because every day I thought that car made me happy, whereas in fact it made me profoundly miserable. Because it broke down all the time, you know, and it didn't have any modern features. It had strange kind of antiquated features. It was always breaking down. And so I think it was 1984, I was emceeing the main stage at Glastonbury. And I, with my live agent then, Bob Gold, we drove down to Glastonbury for the day. But as we drove, I noticed that the Rover was developing this fault, whereas if it dropped below 15 miles an hour, it would just cut out. And I'm really tremendously unmechanical, so I couldn't, you know, get under the bonnet and see what was, you know. So I just thought, well, as long as I keep above 15 miles an hour, I'll be fine. So we drove across the track to the artist's entrance at Glastonbury, and it conked out there as I stopped outside the gates. Some hippies, obviously weak, from the diet that they ate in those days, but took a lot of them. But anyway, some hippies pushed me through the gates, and then I proceeded to MC the main stage at Glastonbury. It was, but it was kind of distracting, you know, because I kept thinking about the car. How am I going to get him? Blah, blah, blah. How am I going to get him? So I remember I introduced Elvis Costello, who was the headline act. And he, as to the strains of, appropriately enough, his first number, which was Accidents Will Happen, the gates of the artist's enclosure swung open. Now I revved the Rover. I said, as long as I don't drop below 15 miles an hour, as long as I can get to the main road across this track, I'll be fine. Unfortunately, in the period between me getting there and you know, the day progressing, people had erected their teepees and stuff on the track itself. So like I'm in this truck. So the people, first thing people saw of me was this black car. I mean, a very sinister looking black car with the headlights on high beams, swerving across the track. And people going, "Hi, Alexi, I really like," oh, boom. And I say, sorry, can't drop below 15 miles an hour. Otherwise, the car conks. So I was just swerving. And people started getting angry, you know, because I was hurtling across Glastonbury, high beams, black car, you know, 20 miles an hour. And so this crowd started to gather behind me, and there were people with pitchforks and chasing after me. And I'm going, "Oh, it's out the way, out the way." And they go, "Lexi, I love," boom, like that. I'm swerving across the track and, you know, knocking down fucking teepees and yurts as I go, and, you know, swerving to avoid children and stuff. And finally, I got onto the main road, and I did a handbrake turn, swerved onto the main road, hit the country road, got to the M4, got home without stopping. But I was picking Dernal and beads out of the radiator for days, really. But that is man who emailed Mike. That is when I ran you over at Glastonbury in 1984. And I'd like to say sorry for anybody I hit. It was the car's fault. It was.
So it's justified. So like, if you hadn't almost killed him, you wouldn't have been able to get home that day.
No, exactly. I would have had to stay at Glastonbury.
So you're like, you're Keanu Reeves, and he's Sandra Bullock.
Yeah, it was. It was literally a speed situation where I couldn't get that car. Was a nightmare. I was so happy when I sold it.
Yeah, I was going to ask what happened to it.
I sold it to a rugby playing Catholic priest who lived in Bolton, and as far as I know, it's still going, I think. In fact, if anybody still owns that car, BMT, I can still remember the number plate, it's BMT 527H. If you are now the current owner of BMT527H, I would be interested to hear from you. I used to go just kind of by accident to the odd kind of Rover owner's show, and there was one where you had to guess the spare part, and so there'd be a spare part in a bag, and you just had to put your hands inside the bag and feel it, and then say, this is a fuel pump.
Is that Halloween? Like
People, they were so intimate with these things that they could put their hands inside a bag and feel a spare part and say correctly what it was. You had to feel it, you see. You put your hands in the bag, you'd feel the spare part. I don't know what you're thinking.
That's a carburetor.
Yeah, you'd say this is a alternator or a fuel pump.
Is this at car conventions, did you say?
This would be at a Rover show, yeah. This would be the Rover owner's show.
You mentioned Triumph motorbikes on your last bike ride.
Yes.
You really split the crowd with that. So you were bemoaning that the British police, this is on Alexi's bike ride, lockdown bike rides, which are available on his YouTube channel. Just look for Alexi Sale. You were bemoaning that the British police don't use, of all the things to complain about with the police, don't...
yeah. All the injustices in the world today and all the scandals connected with the police, this is what I choose to focus on, is what motorbikes they ride. Anyway, yeah, go on.
They don't use British bikes. Their motorbikes are always BMWs. Does that go for their motor cars as well?
No, the motor cars are kind of, they use a huge variety of different cars, really. Yeah.
But all their bikes tend to be BMWs. That's something I've noticed before. And you were wondering, why don't they use Triumph bikes? Why aren't they British bikes? And then, so half people on YouTube are saying Triumph are shit and they don't manufacture well enough, on a grand enough scale to keep up with the production. But then half of the people... agreed with you.
I haven't looked. Yeah, I haven't really looked of late at what Triumph are up to. Initially, because I'm kind of interested in design and manufacturing in a way. And when what happened with Triumph was that obviously, like all British manufacturing, it collapsed. But then it was bought by this property developer. I think it was called John Rolls. I'm not sure. Anyway, he built a whole new in Meriden in Coventry. He built like a ground up. Factory, and then he started making these motorbikes, which were kind of a modular. The engines were a modular construction, so you could do a two-cylinder or a four-cylinder, and they seem very. I've never ridden one. I mean, I've got a full motorbike license. Maybe we'll go into that one day, but it's a long time since I've ridden any motorbike, and I haven't ridden a Triumph, but they look very stylish. They seem very popular. I know they made. You know, the ones like you'd seen like American TV shows, like I know Louis C.K. one episode rode a Triumph Bonneville, you know, which is a kind of a modern iteration of one of Triumph's classic 1950s bikes. And they did used to make big touring bikes. I think they weren't shaft drive, which the BMWs are. They were chain drive. But it seemed, you know, I couldn't see why you couldn't use them as police bikes. Now, somebody, I saw emailed in and said, well, one, they're all made in Thailand now, but two, they don't make those big kind of touring bikes anymore. That I don't know. So,
well, I've got this for you. This is from Ira on the YouTube. Triumph was the preferred motorcycle choice of most British police forces until the factory closed down in 1983. Yeah. When it opened again under new ownership, nearly all forces had already changed over to BMW. So maybe they were like... They got into their new bikes by then.
Yeah, but they could, you know. I mean, I'm not patriotic, but, you know, I mean, I'm not that kind of empty kind of patriotism. But it seems to me, if you got this really stylish British product, why wouldn't you ride that rather than a Bimmer, really? But there may be other reasons, you know, why. Just, it's, I don't know, it just struck me as odd. I would say it seemed like a fantastic, you know, British motor industry is in the second half of the 20th century, you know, is in many ways a story of failure. But it seemed that the guy that, you know, built up Triumph, that he'd made all the right decisions, really. They looked fantastic, motorbikes. And I remember there was a friend of mine had a Triumph Rocket, which was the biggest motorbike in the world, biggest engine and stuff. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, that's good. That's...
I don't think it
just goes some way to countering the mini metro. Sorry,
I don't think it's blind patriotism either, because I think sometimes the most patriot people, they don't think of these simple things. Whereas, like, for me, it's more about, well, for environmental reasons, for economical reasons, it makes sense to keep buy British and
keep it in house.
Support our neighbors and our communities by buying their products and not importing everything. But and that's and stay I'm, local, I'm not a flag waving patriot by any means.
No. Anyway, so that could be a long running. This could go on forever. This debate, really, which you know is fine. Interested in your contributions.
Well, we've got tons of emails. We got so many emails. Like, I'm so happy and so proud of all of our listeners for, you know, reaching out and connecting. And there's no way in hell I'll ever get to every single email. So please don't be offended if we don't get round to reading yours. But, you know, I've handpicked some. First off, there we have, seeing as you talked about Keir so much today, we had an email from someone called Keir, and they just were, they were just wanted to let off some steam because they're very sad about their name. And
yeah, it's like if my former my editor at my editor at Bloomsbury, my publisher, she was called Alexa, which you know must be like you're like oh man,
yeah, and a lot of people still in the emails. People emailing us are spelling your name wrong. And I'm like, you're literally listening to our show and it's on your phone screen, his name. You can...
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. I want to... Okay, I've got so many. It's really hard to pick. Okay, look, I'm going to start on this one. This really caught my eye. Someone sent in a photograph. Their friend was in Kingston, Jamaica.
Yeah.
In a place called Island Records.
Yeah.
And on the wall, there's a photo of you, Alexi.
Yeah.
And you're sitting at a table and there's a can of beer next to you and someone's got their arm around you.
Yes.
And that person is Sting.
Yes.
And you're looking very chummy.
Yeah. Well, that's all true. Yeah.
And he has one question. He says, you did punch him, right?
No, I didn't. Well, I was, when I, during my recording career, I was actually on Island Records and I was an Island record. I was on the same label as Grace Jones and I think via, kind of, you know, Kid Creole and the Coconuts and Was Not Was and Marianne Faithfull and it was the guy that did Addicted to Love, Robert Thing and
Robert Palmer,
Gregory Isaacs, and I knew none of these people. I never had anything to do with any of them. But I was on Island Records, and it's one of the things that I've written about this, but in my autobiography. But one of the things about being a star, and I was a big star in the 80s, was that you become friendly with other stars, and so I thought, well, I'll give it a go. There's a lot of people who most stars just hang out with other stars, really. And that's kind of it's also how you increase your star power because you kind of gang together, and so you increase each other's luminosity. So when we did The Secret Policeman's Other Ball, Sting said to me, you're very funny, aren't you? So I said, yeah. And so I thought, well, I'll give it a go. I'll be Sting's mate. I'll be his celebrity mate, we'll hang out together. And it didn't really last very long. Really, it didn't. I suppose I'm incapable of doing that. Really, I'm incapable of.
Yeah, I've noticed.
I always say something or do something. I'm not. Well, I can be mates with somebody like Stu. I think who's not. Who's also, or has very ambiguous feelings about stardom. But I couldn't do it, I couldn't, it was all right. He's an interesting guy, and I'm actually still friendly, very close friends with his first wife. But
on the record, I don't see why people are so inclined to hate Sting. I think that's such a strong feeling to have. I don't know what he's done. So, forgive me if he's, actually cancelled for a legitimate reason. But all I know, all I can see is that he started off in a pretty damn good band and made some fucking absolute classic songs that will be remembered forever, and then became kind of mediocre in his middle age and later years.
Yeah.
Musically speaking, he made kind of like background music for some classic movies. He's had a few hits in his solo career as well, but he's not done anything offensive.
Well, exactly. He's not the worst, is he? You know, and I think he was partly because he pontificated is why, because he made pronouncements about the rainforest and people then kind of that put people's backs up in some way. I think that's why people, that's partly why people kind of slagged him off really. You know, as if he kept his head down, he would have. He's not.
Of course. Yeah.
It's like you say, it's hard really to pick on him, really. And we, me and him, as it were, starred in a film together in the kind of the nadir of his acting career. It was a film called The Bride, which was a feminist remake of the film The Bride of Frankenstein, in which he played Dr. Frankenstein. And Jennifer Beals from Flashdance played the woman that he creates. And after making a terrible monster, he makes a terrible monster, which is Clancy Brown, a terrific actor from still great comic actor. She's very funny in the Coen Brothers film Hail Caesar, for example, and of course the Nasty Warden in The Shawshank Redemption. Yeah, a really nice guy as well. So he makes Clancy Brown, which is a bit of a mistake, and then he makes Jennifer Beals. And it was actually the script, in a way. It was an interesting meditation on kind of male-female relations and also this kind of, you know, setting yourself up as God. And I played an evil circus owner. And, you know, people can probably find the film somewhere on
YouTube. I'm looking at it now.
It's fucking awful.
It's not got a great rating.
No, how many, what sort of ratings it got?
It's 27% on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's not good, is it, really?
It's not the worst. Is it, at least, like, entertainingly bad?
I don't know. I haven't watched it in, again, if people want to watch it and tell me. It's, we kind of spent the summer together in the south of France. We made it in Carcassonne in the south of France. And it was a kind of, in fact, I drove down there in my Rover P5B, in fact, because this filming was suspended. Coming right back to the anecdotes, the filming was suspended because I'll tell that story another time. But we all went home, and then when we got the order to come back, I drove down there in my Rover P5B. So
the poster looks beautiful. It's got the castle on fire in the background. The cast is definitely notable. Interesting that Frankenstein. He created Jennifer Beale's character in the Frankenstein fashion.
He made Jennifer, not a character, literally made her. Yeah.
But why isn't she all like stitched up and in pieces? She looks like very beautiful and elegant. Okay. So you were in a film with Sting as well.
Yeah.
Let's get him on the show.
I wonder. That'd be funny.
Of old acquaintances, I've got another email that asked about your appearance on Penn and Teller, The Unpleasant World of Penn and Teller.
Yeah.
I went and found that clip, and it's, you do a bit of stand-up on there, so it's not like you were being interviewed by them or anything, but did you make a relationship with Penn? I'm a fan of Penn and Teller's.
Yeah. Yeah, I went when I've only been to New York once. I was actually making a movie, the Whoops Apocalypse movie that we talked about on an earlier podcast. We were doing that in Miami, and then I went up to New York, and it was when I was kind of thinking about, the first time I was thinking about maybe working in the United States, and I met, for some reason, with a lot of PR people. And I found that you can get a really nice lunch if you put yourself up as a prospective client with PR people. They will buy you a really nice lunch. And I remember we had a lunch with the guy who did the PR for Frank Sinatra's funeral. But also, while I was in New York, I went to see Penn and Teller doing the off-Broadway show at the time. And people had recommended them. And then I went backstage and chatted. I think maybe they were fans because they'd seen The Young Ones. And so when they came over, they asked me to do their show, whenever that was, and so I did it. But again, that's another fail. Yeah, I should be, you know, I should be good friends with Penn and Teller, but I failed to, you know, to take it beyond doing that TV show. But they're really, they're interesting, interesting actors.
You followed their work, or Penn Jillette in particular? Have you, like, do you follow, like, what he talks about?
No, not since. No,
he's quite
not
a
since,
famous,
no.
like, libertarian atheist and skeptic, but very politically minded and really, libertarian is his official stance.
Right.
I would love to hear you going at it.
Some sympathy with that. Yeah, is he the one that doesn't talk or the one that does in the act?
Yeah, he does it all in sign language. But it's American. No, but American sign language, unfortunately.
Is he the little one or the big one?
He's the big one. No, clearly not great friends.
So the other one doesn't talk even in...
The one who doesn't talk is called Teller. That's how you can remember.
Right, okay. I also, we were talking about this before we came on air, but I also, since we're doing emails, I also got this email to my much neglected website, which is where I haven't written anything on it since November 2020. But this is, I thought this is very sweet. I like, you know, I like kind of criticism, really, if it's interesting, you know. She says, I'm a massive fan of your work, but since lockdown, your producer, which is probably you, seems to have panicked like all producers and managers, and it feels that they want you to do this to be relevant. Talking about the podcast, it's entitled I Am a Fan, But ... the podcast ... if you're relevant. You don't. We still remember you forever, and clearly you don't want to do the podcast. Or are you being ironic? And this is ever so sweet, really, because I think she thinks that I'm, or she feels that I'm being held hostage, or maybe to being forced to do this podcast. Because I'm not, you know, I am, well, because of what I talk about. Her writing partner, she does a Sandeep Mahal, she also does a podcast herself, and they write anyway. She says, apologies for this. I promised my writing partner I would email you. He loves your podcast as a legitimate fan, whereas I'm a fan of all your other work. And she says, but it's kind of sweet, really, that she's worried about me. And to address your fears, it's complicated, isn't it? And I mean, I'm kind of Stu talks about this as well, where you have a kind of comic persona, which is not quite you, which, you know, is more grumpy than you are. So some, when I talk about not wanting to do the podcast, it is, there's an element of truth in it. But what I'm trying to talk about really is, I mean, what were you saying before? You were saying about how somebody else emailed in and said that they liked, but I don't pretend that the world of podcasting is, you know, all fucking fantastic.
Yeah, I had a really nice email saying how they really appreciate this show because it doesn't come off as desperate. And I don't want to bag on. The reason I approached you to make this podcast is because podcasting is my favorite format, my favorite medium. I listen to podcasts more than I do anything else. I'm a big fan of podcasts, but I do get what people are saying. Like, everyone and their dog has a fucking podcast, and every comedian basically... It feels like you're not actually a comedian unless you have a podcast or five, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they're just desperate to be out there, and they're all shilling their Patreon or selling mattresses or whatever they can do to stay relevant. Whereas, you know, okay, this was probably the most casual hostage taking that's ever occurred on Earth, me coercing you into doing this. But I think you saw it as a leisurely activity. Yeah. This is a leisurely activity for you. Like, it's fucking lockdown. Yeah. There's nothing else. There's nothing else to fucking do at the moment.
Actually, I'm really busy, but we can talk about what I've been up to as well in a while. But but also, well, you know, I'm interested in, you know, this is true of all political coverage or entertainers. You know, that what we are presented with is a simple message, you know, like on the other extreme, you know, the left is bad, they're all racist, the right is good, you know, show business is wonderful, charity's great, comic relief's an amazing thing, you know, Captain Tom, you know, yada yada yada, blah blah blah, you know. And it's the truth is that the world is much more complex, and this is the truth that they hide from you because they don't want you to see, you know, the nuanced nature of reality. And my, you know, the great American filmmaker Albert Mazel said, "Tyranny is the death of nuance," and I think that that is profoundly true. That you know, what they don't want you to understand is nuance, is a balanced picture, and that's I mean, in all my work, genuinely, that's what I try and present, is a kind of you know, and in this case, yeah, you know, I'm you know, I want to do this podcast, but on the other hand, I'm 68. You know, it's not my world. You know, I'm kind of confused. I'm confused by it. I've come from a different world where, you know, I used to have authority. You know, I was on the BBC. You know, I had millions and millions of viewers because you had to watch me or there was nothing else on, really. So, and I've come from that world. And now that I'm fighting with fucking influencers who tell you about how to do your makeup and that, it's also, you know, it's a complicated experience for me. So don't worry about me. We'll have a code word for it when I am being held hostage.
Yeah, what's your safe word? What's your safe word?
Ma'am, what's my safe word? It's not a very good film. What's your film? It's not a very good film. It's a girl's night. I don't, there's a film of women, wives gone wild. I don't know. But there's one point where they go to this kind of wild party and the... And one of the guys says, "My safe word is don't stop."
That's a great one.
Yeah, don't great stop. Line. Not a good film, but a great line. My safe word is don't stop. Anyway, so yeah.
On that point, I've obviously noticed that your approach to podcasting, and it's quite refreshing, and I do mirror those. Sentiments in that email about how this is quite refreshing to hear this show not be the same kind of formulaic thing that we're so used to now. And I'm kind of using this as an opportunity to kind of help create something that resembles what podcasting was in its early days, where it was such a loose medium. There was no precedent on how to do it apart from radio broadcasting history, but that's podcasting was invented as an opposition to radio, you know, as something that was breaks free from the shackles of the formula of radio. So now we're finding that podcasts have created their own shackles. You know, they are prisoners of their own iron barred cells. So like, this is such a refreshing thing to work with someone who has no fucking clue, excuse me, what a podcast is, and to do it from the ground up and make something from scratch. And we have yet to really define what this show is. Is it an interview show? Absolutely. Is it a politics show? Is it a celebrity history show? What the fuck is the Excel podcast? Is it a dream interpretation show? Because I have an email from Matt who wants you to help interpret a dream. Do you think you're up to the challenge?
No, but my wife Linda is terribly good at interpreting dreams. So if you tell me the dream and then I will ask her, and then
maybe next time
she will interpret it. Maybe she will interpret it. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe grab a voice note of her interpreting.
Jesus.
Okay. There you go, listener. That's the level we're working at. No, Alex, you're very fucking technologically capable. You've recorded whole BBC Radio 4 series from home and this podcast.
Yeah, somebody else does that. Yeah. The other thing I don't do is plug my own shit, really, because I've literally got a radio series going out at the moment, and I failed to plug it, really. It's called The Absence of Normal.
There we go.
On at 11:30 on BBC on Wednesdays on BBC Radio 4, or listen to it on BBC Sound.
Yes.
God, what's this dream?
Catch up. I recommend it. It's good.
Yeah.
All right. Dear Alexi, he thinks you would make a fabulous dream interpreter. Okay. He's had this recurring dream since he was about 10 and he's now 45.
Okay. Yeah.
And he's never understood its meaning. So here it is. I'm vacuuming around my house when all of a sudden I accidentally hoover up a piece of ham that in my dream I'm convinced is actually my boyhood hero and legendary Liverpool FC striker, Ian Rush.
Okay, yeah.
Then I wake up and he finds it very unsettling.
Oh, okay. Well, I will run that past Linda. I don't know I never met Ian Rush. I met Kenny Dalglish, who was in that squad, but I've never met Ian Rush. But
any initial
sounds interesting.
Any initial reactions? Hoovering up Ian Rush, but he's actually Ham.
I know.
Maybe West Ham.
I don't know. I mean, I'll have to ask Linda. She may have a.
Okay, so we'll leave that with you, Alexi. I'll text you the wording of that dream. And get us I'd love to hear what Linda has to say. Maybe next episode or...
Sure.
Is Alexi still susceptible to hype? This is from Colin. Hi, Colin. Yonks ago on Room 101, you said you were very susceptible to hype of Hollywood, to the hype of Hollywood movies. And then in one of your cycling videos, you mentioned watching the Transformers movies. I was so confused by that. Every time I work with you, Alexi, I learn something about you that's shocking. Your fascination with armed forces and weaponry and tanks. Yeah. Your love for Triumph motorbikes. The fact that you watched Mark, not just the Transformers movie, the one with Mark Wahlberg in it, one of the later ones.
Yeah, Darker than
Side.
Yeah, I can't remember. Or The Last Night.
The Transformer on the left.
Yeah. Ah, fuck knows. Yeah.
But apparently, though, years ago on Room 101, now was that back when Paul Merton did it?
Yes, it was.
I was a little kid then. I remember those. I used to stay up and watch it with my dad all the time. So you told Paul Merton, that you were susceptible to Hollywood hype. Is that still an affliction of yours, Alexi?
Am I still susceptible? I think a bit, really. Yeah, I say I don't know what. Maybe we could look up what I said on Room 101. But
well, do you still get excited about the latest Hollywood releases and stuff? And
it's more. What was I talking about? Being, you know, falsely, you know, kind of, you know. I think I'm probably less. I probably don't believe hype as much as I used to. Really, I was used to, because I was younger, I suppose, partly, and I would be seduced by, you know, this is the new movie and it's going to be fantastic, and I would believe it. But I mean, there's so many. It's happened to me so often, really, that I've you know, I've believed hype, and then it's failed to deliver. That I think I'm finally learning my lesson there. And you know, that's been a kind of an experience over the last 5 years, the Corbyn years, to just see. I mean, I think it's been fantastic for me as an artist in a way, because it's given me a whole new kind of area of work. But just to see what a lie our media is, the way that, you know, that in every aspect of the media, you know, even the, you know, a lot of people who call themselves left wing, and obviously all the newspapers and all the TV stations, the way they all lied about Corbyn, absolutely propagated lies. I found myself profoundly shocking. And so I guess I probably am less susceptible to hype now, because our world, the world we live in, is absolutely a lie. But nevertheless, that Marky Mark, I like. I mean, the first Transformers movie is really good. I mean, Shia LaBeouf is driving this car that turns into like a person. Yeah. I mean, fucking hell, man, you know?
It's
making a profound philosophical point. You know, they obviously... They get less and less attractive as they go on, really.
What about the OG Transformers cartoon movie? That was phenomenal. That one's great. A soundtrack by Weird Al Yankovic. James L. Jones, I think, does the voiceover of Optimus Prime.
Right.
Great animation. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know nothing about this. But it's also, what watching something like Transformers movie is also a side effect, as it were, of going to bed early. Because as I got older, you know, I'll go to bed earlier. And then ITV2, I got, because I got a telly in the bedroom, which I shouldn't have really. ITV2 shows these movies, you know, like Transformers movies, start around about 10 o'clock. Oh, they start about 9, but I start watching them at 10, so I never know quite what the fuck's going on.
Watched it in bed.
Yeah, it's not a good idea. But cause, and also, I wrote about this, but it's a. Does this. In particular, I think on ITV2, or it might have moved to 5-star now, there's this Tom Cruise movie called The Edge of Tomorrow.
Fantastic.
It's a fucking great film, right?
That's genuinely, fuck Transformers. That is genuinely a really good film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Much underrated, I think. Not particularly a hit. I mean, Tom Cruise is a bit like Sting, really. I mean, he's somebody who is derided in many ways. Obviously the Scientology is a problem. But on the other hand, he's made quite a few films that are very critical of the United States, for instance. Because there's another, I mean, Doug Liman, there's another, it's called Made in America, which I think is directed by Doug Liman, who did
the first. Yeah, he's the drug trafficker.
And it's about a true story about a guy who starts flying drugs for the CIA or whatever. And it's profoundly critical of... United States, you know, Born on the 4th of July, again, is a massive critique of the hypocrisy of the U.S. war in Vietnam. Even The Last Samurai, in a sense, is a critique of kind of capitalism. You know, he's made some interesting films, Tom Cruise. Anyway, so yeah, Edge of Tomorrow, fucking amazing movie. But I kept watching it on ITV2 and coming in, it's about a man who, you know, lives the same day over and over again because he's killed this alien. But I kept coming in and never quite knowing what was going on. So I was sort of partly reliving the experience that Tom Cruise was having in the movie. That I was continually watching this movie. I mean, genuinely, I was continually watching this movie and I never knew what was going on. I never knew why he was being forced into that commando unit that goes to fight the... goes to fight the aliens on the beaches of northern France and all that. Yeah. Emily Blunt, she's great. So badass in that. Wow, yeah. Man. I think in the end, I got it on like Amazon Prime or something and watched it just to find out what was going on, really. But I was genuinely repeating that experience of living that same day over and over again by watching this movie over and over again. It's a great
film.
That
genuinely is worth the hype, that film. I think that's every now and then Tom Cruise makes like a, in quotes, indie film. Like that's more of a kind of a small project, which could have been a lot more successful.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Collateral, you know, Jamie Foxx.
Really dark. Yeah.
Directed by Michael Mann. Yeah, amazing.
I think you get this idea that a overly religious performer is going to do really sanitized, easy, riskless performances, whereas Tom Cruise, he like F's and blinds and does all sorts.
And I
of
suppose in a way, if we're talking about nuance, that is a sort of point that I'm making, in a sense that you can obviously think that Tom Cruise is a weirdo and, you know, he's got weirdo religious views, but you can still accept that he can be a fantastic actor and has done some really interesting projects. And there's not there's no dissonance between those two points. It's about accepting nuance. It's about accepting the complexity of life, really. I think
bringing it round. Tom Cruise, one of my favorites. Hype. I think it's hype and hope. There's only one letter between them, isn't there? What do you think of that?
You should be writing Hallmark.
All right, I was going to make a joke about The Bride actually being a lot better than Rotten Tomatoes says it is. It's worth at least 80.
It's not.
But yeah, that's no one's going to believe that.
It's not.
Okay.
But it's interesting enough, started by a guy called Frank Rodham, who has a sideline in developing show formats. And I think he devised MasterChef, I think, is a Frank Rodham format. Huh. He also did Alvida Saint Pet. He came up with the formula for that, I think. Unless I'm getting him mixed up with somebody else.
Frank Rodham. is an English film director, businessman, screenwriter, television producer, and publisher. Best known as the creator of Ulf Wiedersehen Pet, director of Quadrophenia, Get Out.
Yes.
He graduated from London Film School. Is that the third fact about Frank Rodden? Where he fucking graduated? Okay, what else? He directed The Bride.
Yeah.
Is that why you brought him up?
Yeah. Why was that just random?
But you're saying he made Rotten Tomatoes as well?
No, I'm saying he devised MasterChef, I think. Doesn't it say there somewhere about his... He devises a lot of, like, show formats.
MasterChef, correct. Yes,
yeah,
he did.
MasterChef.
Wait, why? I thought you said he founded Rotten Tomatoes.
No, I said he devised MasterChef. Even you're not listening to my podcast.
Rotten Tomatoes. Okay. I'm going to have to listen back to that.
How long have we been going now?
Definitely long enough. Okay. I'm keeping that in. We've got time for one more email, though, but I'm going to let you choose.
All right.
Do you want an email about, or maybe I should do some friendship applications?
Yeah, because, we should do the friendship applications, because you did, on a previous podcast, I should say, I foolishly offered that if people said they wanted to be my friend, I'd send them a card at Christmas or something, or give them a prize or some shit. I don't know what it was now, but
yeah, you were gonna do
I could certainly do
like an electronic Christmas greetings card that was kind of vague enough that it could apply to anyone. We were gonna come up with something very clever and digital to send out to people, but we've still got till Christmas to think of an idea.
Yeah, fuck it. Yeah, it's only Mark.
We can do this, man. I believe in us. Okay, let's do some shout-outs to some friendship apps. Like, for example, thank you, Neil. Thank you, Laura. I don't know. I feel weird reading out people's surnames on a podcast. That's why.
Yeah.
But there's, Neil and Laura. There's millions of them. But, Mark, someone called Borg, Graham, Kev, Ellen, Giorgio. Thank you all, guys. There's so many more. Matt. It's just the name of English names. Satan sent you one.
Okay, well, I'd just like to say to all you people who are applying to be my friend that there's a rigorous process going on behind the scenes to see whether you're suitable. If you notice that you're that somebody is following you, or there's a suspicious van parked outside your house,
yeah, we're just monitoring you,
or
guys.
Or your mail is being opened, then that could very well be my team of friendship examiners seeing whether you are suitable for to be my friend, to see whether you got anything in your background that is unacceptable, or if there isn't, then we're gonna have great times together. We're gonna woo, hey man.
Oh yeah, if you pass the vetting process.
Exactly.
Hey, could you give Tony Canavan a shout out? He's not very well and he's one of your biggest fans.
Yes, yeah, certainly. Hey Tony, I'm sorry that you're not very well, but I hope listening to this podcast at least lifts your spirit.
He's pretty sure he went to Alsop High School with you.
The name sounds... Well, I went to Alsop High School, so if he did as well, then, and he's the same age as me, then yeah, the name sounds vaguely familiar. So, yeah, I think we probably did.
Yeah, they love your Great Bus Journeys of the World book, and whenever he stays in a B&B, he has an overwhelming urge to put up a homemade sign reading "A dead badger must be kept in the sink at all times." So yeah, hey Tony Canavan, thanks so much for listening. We're not do shout outs for any Tom, Dick or Harry, but I felt that one was worthy. This is a we're gonna end the show with this one. This is a friendship request.
All right.
From Eve Wignall.
Oh right, yes.
Yeah. She says, "Thank you for the mention on episode 6. Very kind." She is the your old makeup artist who used to create Bobby Chariot.
Yes,
out of your blank canvas, she would create Bobby Chariot.
Yeah, well, I mean, Eve was much more responsible for the look of. Well, was completely responsible for the look of Bobby, really. I was really, and so I remember she did this brilliant wig, which this kind of thinning hair that was fantastic. And then she also, I think we went together to have his teeth done his teeth, which are still in my loft. And Eve, yeah, I think Eve did two series of the All New Alexis L Show, and she was great. I mean, it was, you know, and I don't know if I spoke about this before, but that's one of the many things that in the, you know, the kind of the taking apart of the BBC, that's one of the things that's been lost, I think, is that you used to, the BBC used to be this amazing institution where you, you go in as a trainee makeup artist and then would be trained and then would work at the BBC. And all that kind of collective, all that collective memory of the BBC, all that collective talent has been lost, really. And I think it's a tremendous shame.
Yeah. Yeah, I worked at the BBC during its kind of, when that was already thinning out. They kind of...
Yeah, it was, you know, yeah, it just means everything takes longer, costs more. You know, what's the fucking point of, you know, that kind of reorganisation that makes everything worse? But in many ways, as the Jam sang, this is the modern world! Yeah, I would just say I spoke about what I'm doing. I'm not going to talk about it in detail now, but why I've been away. I will just say one word, casualty. You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkuti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing, and big thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. And most importantly, emails by you. If you have any questions or comments, then send them to alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, bye.